Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this New Year's Day. Thanks for being here with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And we've got an open forum for you for this New Year's Day, but it's an internet open forum. Lots of cool questions for Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, and so many other things. Also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Welcome back, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy, Cy Kellett.
I am looking into getting myself some banana candy after that last hour. I got a I don't know what Darren mentioned Runts, and I kind of remember those. So I don't know why I have no memory of having eaten banana candy.
There are others too. In fact, I remember eating little candies that are shaped like bananas that are banana flavored.
All right. Well,
they'd also have like banana, those chalky candies. Some of them were banana flavored too.
You know where you find candy stores? In airports. I guess everybody's fired up for candy at the airport. Because you,
well, you're getting on an airplane. You may as well self-soothe.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. So, all right. Next time I'm in an airport, which I hope will not be anytime soon, enough traveling for a while. But next time I'll see if I can find some banana candy at the candy store. Open forum means that people get to ask Jimmy whatever they want, and people know when it's Jimmy, they can ask whatever they want. And this one comes from Hubert. Is there any real evidence for the existence of Bigfoot?
Well, there's certainly evidence that's proposed for Bigfoot, you know, like all of the tracks, for example, that Bigfoot is reported to have left at various locations. I mean, that's a form of evidence. Now, what you make of that evidence is kind of up to you. There are some tracks that are clearly fake, you know, that are made with fake footprints. There are also other tracks that may be mistaken, you know, paw prints from animals, particularly if they're in snow or mud or some medium that distorts what the original track looked like. You know, like if you have an animal stepping almost in its own previous tracks, it could look like one elongated track. But there are other tracks that are harder to explain that way. The book that's in print that I'm aware of that tries to mount the largest scientific case for the existence of Bigfoot is called Sasquatch. That's the name of the book, Sasquatch. It's by a professor of anatomy and anthropology named Jeff Meldrum. M-E-L-D-R-U-M. So if you'd like a really, and I plan to cover it in the future on Mysterious World. I did way back in like episode 2 or 3, 5 years ago, I did a basic look at Bigfoot, but I plan on revisiting it now that I've been able to dig into the research deeper. And I will be covering information from Sasquatch by Jeff Meldrum.
Oh, very good. Well, we got that to look forward to then. Thank you very much for the question. Appreciate that. That was Hubert. And you know what? I'm going to go to Joe's question. We'll have a little fun to start the hour here. Joe wants to know, are there any words that rhyme with orange?
In English.
go ahead, Jimmy.
Yeah. So this is so famously, orange is not supposed to have any words that rhyme with it in English. And it doesn't have any direct rhymes that most people know about. But we've actually covered this question before on the show. This is not the first time I've had this question. But I'll answer it again just to be nice. So there are various words in English that are sort of slant rhymes with orange, like scavenge.
Oh, yeah.
Is a slant rhyme for orange. There are others like plunge, grunge, sausage, sponge, things like that. But are there any words that are direct rhymes for orange? The answer is yes. There are at least two. One of them is the word sporange. A sporange is a kind of spore sac, meaning a little growth that spores come in. Another is a place name, Blorenge, which is a mountain in Wales. So you've got Sporenge and Blorenge as direct rhymes for orange.
It literally sounds like you asked a six-year-old child to make up those rhyming words.
Well, you ask for words that rhyme, they're going to sound like orange with slight variations on the front of the word. That's what a rhyme is.
I feel like I've tried to make like a slant rhyme with Stonehenge at some point, but it doesn't really work. But
yeah. Did you ever watch H.R. Puff and Stuff, Cy Kelly?
Oh, yes. Where is he when things get rough?
Yeah, well, he's your friend when things get rough.
Oh, he's your friend when things get rough.
So for people who may not know, Sid and Marty Krofft did a live-action children's show back in the late 1960s called H.R. Puff and Stuff. He was a talking dragon that was the mayor of Living Island, where everything was alive. Even things like houses were alive. And the antagonist on the series, the main antagonist, was a character played by Billy Hayes named Witchy Poo, who was a witch. And this show, being in the late 1960s, had musical elements.
I know where we're going now.
And there were songs. Like, for example, the human protagonist, who was sort of the guy, the kid that H.R. Puff and Stuff looked out for, was a human named Jimmy. And in one episode, Witchy Poo turns Jimmy into a mechanical boy. And so, this being a show with music, Jimmy gets to sing I'm a mechanical boy, like a mechanical toy. And he has this whole song about being a mechanical boy. Well, Witchy Poo also got to sing. And one of her songs was Oranges, Porringes, Who Cares? There Ain't No Rhyme for Oranges. Except there is. Sporange and Blorange both rhyme with orange.
Oh, Witchy Poo. Both a moral and a practical failure, Witchy Poo. Joe, thanks for the question. This one comes from Mike. I heard a claim that the Pope changed the Bible for the, is it Panare people, Jimmy?
Yeah, sure.
Panari people. And it blames them for Jesus's crucifixion. It didn't sound right, but I couldn't find any evidence either way. They claimed evidence from a book, but that's all I've heard.
Well, I haven't seen primary source documents on this either, but I have read about, you know, what supposedly happened. And it wasn't the Pope, as far as I know, who was involved. So the Panari people live in the Amazon in Venezuela. And they are a tribal people. And in the 1970s, Christian missionaries started working with them. And they had some initial difficulty communicating the substance of the Christian faith to the Panari people. And so what at least the story is they rewrote the Gospels to bring out a truth. The truth is that Jesus died for our sins. So there's a sense in which all human beings are responsible, because we're all sinners, we're all responsible for Jesus's death. And consequently, you know, there, you'll find various magisterial documents saying, so don't just blame Jews, we're all responsible because we're all sinners. So you can't look at any one group and treat them as, oh, they're the ones responsible for Jesus's death. We're all responsible. Well, to help make the Christian faith vivid for the Panari people, what these missionaries did, allegedly with the consent of the local Catholic Church, was they kind of did a representation of the Gospels where they highlighted the fact that the Panari people, like other people, were responsible for Jesus's death. And so there's reportedly like a scene in this rewritten version of the Gospels where you have kind of like a war council of Panari people plotting the death of Jesus to highlight the fact that all of us are sinners. And it says like they did this because they were wicked, you know, which is a fundamental truth. We all have wickedness that we struggle with, and so we're all responsible for Jesus's death. And this was a way of helping make that emotionally engaging for the Panari people. It's not, in essence, different from the message that's presented to all of us. You know, whenever missionaries go anywhere, they explain we're all sinners and we're responsible, and Jesus died for us, so there's a sense in which we're responsible for his death. Although that's not the whole story, because he also freely chose to die on our behalf. So there's another side to the story. I don't know how, I would presume that that other side of the story got communicated to the Benari people as well, you know, because that's another part of the gospel message that's important. The gospels stress it. I mean, Jesus even says, no man takes my life from me, I lay it down of my own accord. So I would assume that in the fullness of time, the Penare got the fullness of the gospel message. And I think it's a little problematic to look at one aspect of what they were told as if it were representative of everything that they did to try to help communicate the Christian faith to the Penare people. Also, frankly, a lot of the people I see telling this story seem to have a bias against evangelization. They treat it like a bad thing that Christians were evangelizing, but from a Christian perspective, it's a good thing to share the gospel with everybody, because it's a message for everybody. You can debate, were the methods that were used in this particular case appropriate to this case, but from a Christian perspective, you shouldn't be dissing the concept of evangelization itself.
Mike, thank you for the question. That brings us to the break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we're doing an internet open forum today. Open forum for Jimmy. People get to ask him whatever they want, but all the questions have already come to us via the internet. I'm going to do a couple questions from Barrett, and this is the first. Barrett asks this, Jimmy: could Genesis chapter 3, verse 15 have any implications for papal infallibility? If the devil bites only the heel and not the head, Christ, then could this be used as evidence for papal infallibility as the visible head of the church?
With the Pope as the visible head of the church, yeah. This is essentially an argument based on the spiritual sense of the text, because there's not the Genesis 3:15 is about snakes and humans. It's not about the Pope and the devil. Now the serpent is a symbol of the devil. And so, you know, and that's something that's confirmed, for example, by the book of Revelation. But if you read the actual curse in Genesis 3:15 about, you know, he's going to strike at your heel and you're going to crush his head and stuff like that, that does apply to Christ and the devil, but literally it's about snakes attacking humans and humans crushing the heads of snakes. In fact, I've done that myself. A number of years ago, I walked out of the back door of Catholic Answers and there was a baby rattlesnake in the parking lot, and it went to rattling at me. And my first thought was, there are women in this building who are wearing sandals. My second thought was, what do you know? My chiropractor was right. I am left-footed. And then because I stomped it. And my third thought was, I've just reenacted Genesis 3:15. You know, literally what it's a prophecy of is humans, is mutual conflict between humans and snakes, but it also applies in the spiritual sense to Christ and the devil. And you could try to apply it, since the Pope is the vicar of Christ, you could try to apply it to a conflict between the Pope and the devil. But be careful, because this is the spiritual sense. And as a result, we can't really use it for apologetic purposes, because it's not going to be convincing to people who don't already believe in papal infallibility. I can't go to someone and say, here's this prophecy about humans crushing snake heads, therefore the Pope is infallible. They're not going to find that persuasive at all. And so St. Thomas Aquinas cautions us against trying to use the spiritual sense of the text to prove things, to prove doctrines. We need to prove doctrines based on the literal sense of the text. Once you've proved the doctrine, the spiritual sense of the text may help illustrate it. But if all you've got is a speculative spiritual sense interpretation, it's not ultimately going to be persuasive for people who don't already believe what you're trying to convince them of.
Thank you for the question. Appreciate that, Barrett. But here's a second one from Barrett. Wants to know, how would you respond to a oneness Pentecostal who claims the Son speaking to the Father is simply God demonstrating how humans ought to behave towards God, similar to how a human teacher might have a sock puppet speak to the teacher in a respectful manner as a demonstration for the students?
Well, I don't know, Cy Kellen. What would say to a oneness Pentecostal who did this?
No. I don't think Jesus is a sock puppet. That's
yeah, well, that's a key problem with this argument. Okay, so for people who may not be aware, oneness Pentecostals are people who believe that there is only one person in the Godhead. They will typically say that that one person is Jesus, and that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are different modes or roles that this one person assumes. So when Jesus is talking to the Father in the Gospels, that presents a problem for oneness Pentecostals, because if Jesus is having a conversation with the Father, that makes it look like the Father and the Son are two different persons, which is what oneness Pentecostals reject. And so in this case, the oneness Pentecostal is trying to come up with a rationale for why the Son would have apparent conversations with the Father. And the proposal is that this is to teach us a lesson, that he's not really talking to the Father. He's showing us how we should relate to the Father. And he has this imaginative example of a teacher using a sock puppet in class. Okay, well, there are a few differences. One of them is Jesus does not, between the two situations, one of them is Jesus is not the same thing as a sock puppet. If you got a teacher using a sock puppet talking to the sock puppet, it's obvious you've got a human talking to a sock puppet, because the sock puppet is right there. You can see it. And it's obvious this is an imaginary conversation for one purpose or another. The situation of a teacher with a sock puppet visually communicates this is not a real conversation. But we don't have that with Jesus, because he's a human. He's a man. He's human. He's not a sock puppet. And he's having a conversation with the unseen Father just like other humans have conversations with the unseen Father. So if that's what Jesus was trying to teach us, is I'm not really having a conversation with my Father, I'm doing this just to give y'all an example, then he would need to communicate that in some way. And he doesn't. He doesn't say, hey guys, there is, I'm the Father, and now I'm going to put on a little show for you to show you how to be respectful towards me when you talk to me and I'm not seen. He doesn't say anything like that. And consequently, we don't have reason to believe that's what he was doing. Instead, we need to go with the appearance. The appearance is he's having a conversation with the unseen father, just like other people do. And furthermore, if he did want to teach us this lesson, why would he want to teach us to be respectful when we talk to the father? Why would he do this? Because people are already being respectful to the father. You know, I mean, there are lots of people are. And he didn't say, by the way, guys, watch how respectful I'm about to be. So this is just, frankly, this is desperate speculation to try to retrieve a hypothesis that is otherwise damaged by the evidence of the text. The evidence of the text presents this as a real conversation between two distinct persons and not as a kind of didactic, meaning teaching-oriented demonstration that's an imaginary conversation.
Barrett, thank you for both of those questions. It's an open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And Joe asks this. There's a claim circulating online that the Bethlehem shepherds were not only temple shepherds who procured unblemished lambs for sacrifice, but they did so specifically by wrapping a chosen lamb in tight swaddling clothes and then laid it in a manger to keep the animal from thrashing around and injuring itself. The early fathers certainly point out that the swaddling clothes and tomb-like manger point to Christ's death and self-gift as the bread of life. But are there any primary sources that verify the detail about the shepherds wrapping up a lamb in a manger, or is this just speculation without evidence?
This is speculation without evidence, as far as I'm aware. In fact, I have no evidence of first century Jewish Palestinian shepherds wrapping up lambs in swaddling clothes to keep them from injuring themselves. I don't have any evidence of that. Normally what happens when sheep give birth is out pops the baby sheep and then it starts following the mom around and it doesn't get put in swaddling clothes. In fact, you want it up and ambulatory and moving around quickly. So wrapping it up so it can't move doesn't really make a lot of sense from an animal husbandry perspective. I could be wrong about all that, but that's my understanding. I also would challenge the idea that the shepherds in Bethlehem were quote unquote temple shepherds. I have no evidence that the temple had any shepherds in its employ. What I do think there's evidence for is that the sellers of sacrificial animals in the temple complex would have sold sheep for sacrifice. So you didn't have to bring your own all the way from Nazareth or whatever. You could just bring the money and then you could buy a sheep in Jerusalem and then you would offer it at the temple. So the sellers of animals, just like we have the sellers of doves mentioned in the Gospels when Jesus clears the temple, there would have been people selling lambs and oxen and other sacrificial animals. Those are the basic ones. You also have like pigeons and things. But consequently, these sacrificial animal sellers would have needed to source their sheep, and they would have sourced them locally because that's the whole point of selling them at the temple, is so people don't have to transport them long distances. But I don't know that they would have used shepherds in Bethlehem. Bethlehem is 6 miles away from Jerusalem, and they probably would have wanted to source their sheep closer. You don't want to make an unnecessary 4-hour trip. You know, if it takes 2 hours to get to Bethlehem and 2 hours to get back, you don't want to have to do a 4-hour trip just to go get sheep. You'd want shepherds that live in and around Jerusalem to be your sources of sheep for the temple. Also, even assuming there were shepherds in Bethlehem who were working for the sacrificial animal sellers or who were providing sheep to the sacrificial animal sellers, they probably weren't exclusively doing that. And even if there were such shepherds, they probably would have been a small part of the shepherds in the area because sheep were not just used at the temple. You used sheep to get wool. You used sheep for clothing. You used sheep to get meat to eat. The shepherds themselves would get milk to make to drink and to make cheese out of. And so you had a lot of products that you would make from sheep, and use at the temple was a small part of the overall sheep industry in the area. So temple, was there some use of sheep? Yeah, but it was a small part of what big sheep was all about. And so big sheep would have had lots of shepherds who were just ordinary shepherds in this area, like every other area. And so I think it's a mistake that goes beyond the evidence we have to characterize these shepherds as temple shepherds.
Don't get in the way of big sheep, though.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made, and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. It's an internet open forum for this first day of the year. And before we go back to the calls, as I did last hour, I would like to invite you to come with us on our cruise, Catholic Answers Cruise, departing June 29th from Montreal and sailing down the St. Lawrence Seaway, visiting Quebec and Saint-Anne-de-Beaupré, and lots of conversation and talks from historians about the history of Catholicism in the New World. And then we finish up in Boston on July 6th. If you want to find out about coming with us on the Catholic Answers Cruise to a part of the world that is just beautiful in June and July, check it out at CatholicAnswersCruise.com. And if you sign up between now and the Feast of the Epiphany, January 6th, use the promo code Pope Peter. When you use the promo code Pope Peter, you get a discount on your cruise at CatholicAnswersCruise.com. All right, back we go to the questions, which, as I said, have come to us in the various ways questions can get to people over the internet. And this one comes from Damon. What sacrament can angels administer and or confect?
It's a plural there.
What sacraments can angels administer and or confect? I have heard of angels both giving communion as well as appearing as a priest to give confession to someone who was desperately seeking to go to confession.
Well, I don't think we have a clear answer on this. I am aware of reports of experiences where angels have done things like this. For example, the Fatima children Lucia, Francisco, and Jacinta reported that before the Virgin Mary appeared to them, that an angel showed up and gave them Holy Communion. And so, you know, that's it. That doesn't necessarily mean the angel had the ability to confect the Eucharist. The angel would essentially be functioning as a really extraordinary minister of Holy Communion in this situation. Not just an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, but a really extraordinary one since he's an angel. On the other hand, this could be just a purely visionary experience. It might not have been physical. On the other hand, confession is an information-based sacrament. And so if an angel hears your confession, I would assume that it would have the same effect as a normal confession. Otherwise, why would the angel be doing this? So I think that the answer is we really don't know enough about these experiences, but I don't rule out the possibility that they are authentic and that they mean what they look like they mean. In fact, I can't rule out that angels are capable of performing all of the sacraments, because the earthly liturgy is meant to be a pattern of the heavenly liturgy. So just like there are human priests here on earth, there are angels functioning as priests in heaven. And we see them at various points in the New Testament, in the Bible, such as in the New Testament, where you have the four living creatures that surround God's throne and participate in the worship of God, and they're effectively functioning as priests. There are other individuals, though, that are members of the heavenly court. Now, today, we think of any created spirit that's not a human as an angel. We just apply the term angel to, it's a created spirit, it's not a human, therefore it's an angel. So you essentially have three categories. You've got God, who's an uncreated spirit. You've got angels that are created spirits and not humans. And then you've got humans who are created spirits that are human. And that's what we're aware of. Originally, though, that things weren't conceptualized quite this way. In the Old Testament, the Israelites conceptualized God as a heavenly king. And just like kings have courts, God was understood to have a court. And there were different members of this court. Some of the members of the court were known as sons of God, just like an earthly king has his sons have prominent places in his court. So there were spirits known as sons of God who were talked about in the Old Testament, who are kind of like the high-ranking members of God's court. And you see them, for example, at the beginning of the book of Job, which starts one day when the sons of God were gathering around God in his court. And so these are heavenly spirits. They're created. But they're so close to God, they're called sons of God. And then also in waltzes, Ha-Satan, the accuser, also known as Satan. And Ha-Satan is kind of like the court prosecutor in God's court. It's his job to scope out misdoing in God's kingdom and accuse those people to God. And this day, he accuses Job. He says, Job is a fair-weather friend. Actually, God brings up Job and says, have you noticed my servant Job? And Ha-Satan is like, oh, you know, he's only a fair-weather friend. He's not really your good servant. And so that sets up the dramatic action in the book of Job. So you see here, we've got kind of the royal princes, the sons of God. We've got the court prosecutor. We later meet other members of the heavenly court. There are guards. That's what the seraphim are. Believe it or not, seraphim were like snake-like angels that, and we know what they look like. There are parallels in Egypt. They're called uraeuses. But basically, they're snake-like guards that guard holy space. And it seems weird to us because of the association of the serpent and the devil, to think of God having serpent guards. But if you think like an Israelite in the 8th century BC, oh no, it's not unnatural at all. God's the greatest king. He's going to have the most butch, dangerous guards. He's not going to have wimpy human with wing guards. He's going to have like vicious snake guards that are going to kill anybody that tries to get near God's throne without authorization. So we see guards. We also see commanders. The Hebrew word is sar. Michael is described as a commander in God's army. And so if you got an army, you got soldiers. And then, so we've got all these people. We've got the princes, we've got the prosecutor, we've got the guards, we've got the commanders, we've got the soldiers. Oh, and we have the messengers. Now, messengers are little low-level guys. You know, they run around and take messages places. But that's what the word angel is in Hebrew and in Greek and in Aramaic. The word for angel is the same as the word for messenger. Well, what's happened is today we've latched onto the term for the lowest kind of spiritual creature and expanded it to cover all of them. So now, even though Michael's described in the Old Testament as a commander, we call him an angel. And the prosecutor, oh yeah, he's an angel. He's a fallen one, but now we call him an angel. Mm-hmm. And the sons of God that God lets rule over the nations, oh yeah, those are angels now. So we have collapsed the terminology for all of these different things: guards, commanders, soldiers, princes, prosecutors, and we just call all of them messengers now. So that fact can blind us to the differences between the roles that they play, because the role of a soldier is not the same as the role of a commander, and the role of a guard is not the same as the role of a prince. So it's possible, since we see angels doing priestly services in the heavenlies, it's possible that there are some angelic priests. And these angelic priests might have sacramental abilities that are not broadly shared among all the angels. So it's possible that some of the angels do have priestly functions that allow them to do the sacraments. Now, that's just speculation, but based on reports of things like angels bringing communion or angels hearing a person's confession, I can't rule out that there are some angels who are priests and are given the ability by God to administer sacraments to humans in a valid way.
Damon, thank you for that question. And the next question is also an angel question. So I'm going to go right into that. Anthony asked this, Jimmy: does each person have a guardian angel who specifically has only ever been assigned to them, or do they guard different people throughout their careers, in quotes?
So I think that we have to be careful here, because we have not been told hardly anything about how guardian angels work. We've been told that they exist. Jesus refers in the Gospels to the angels of children never failing to see the face of his Father, which means they always have guaranteed access to the throne room. If an angel learns that something bad is going on with one of their charges, they get straight away admitted to the throne room and get to tell God about it. Yeah. So we know that guardian angels exist, but beyond that, we really don't know how the system works. It is commonly assumed that we each have one guardian angel who is assigned to guard just one person, that's us, and that guardian angel never guards anybody else. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's the way it works, but that's an assumption, and we don't know that. There are other possibilities. It could be, okay, Jimmy Akin has a guardian angel, and once Jimmy Akin is safely in heaven, that guardian angel is freed up for other labor and he can guard somebody else now. That's a possibility. It's also possible that guardians may guard more than one person at a time because they're not subject to human limitations. So it could be Jimmy Akin has a guardian angel and Cy Kellett has a guardian angel, and they're the same guardian angel, that he's guarding both of us at once. Mm-hmm. And he can do that as long as he has the ability to do that. And so God's not going to assign an angel to a task the angel is not competent for. So if God has given angels the ability to guard more than one person, then there's no problem with people sharing a guardian angel. And who knows how many they might share, or who knows how many people an individual angel is guarding. Maybe an angel can guard 500 people at once or 1,000 people at once. What we can be confident of is that he will be competent at his task. If his task is to guard 1,000 people, God will make sure he has assigned the right angel to that task and everybody will be properly guarded. By the way, in light of my comments about our terminology for the different members of the heavenly court, notice the paradox here with us talking about guardian angels.
Oh, right.
So that would mean guardian messengers. Are they guardians? Are they guards? Or are they messengers? Notice the paradox. They're really guards. They're angel. They're created spirits that God has assigned to guard us, so they are guards. But yet, because we've just lumped every created spirit under the heading messenger, we call them guardian messengers or guardian angels. But they're really guards.
Anthony, thank you very much for the question. I have the image, Jimmy, of you safe in heaven and the guardian angel getting another assignment and being like, oh man, I got to do mysterious world for all those years. And now I gotta guard somebody else.
No, that's not how angels look at it. Angels would look at angels would rejoice in any task that God gives them. And so any new person would not be unfavorably compared to me by the angel, but would be celebrated by the angel as a new opportunity to help guide a soul to heaven with different and interesting circumstances that differ from those that applied to me.
Oh, yeah. All right. Damon and Anthony, both of you, thank you for the questions about these intelligent spiritual beings. We'll take a very quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Human beings are God's greatest masterpiece. Every person is made in the image and likeness of God. But every saint, that is, every person who accepts God's invitation, his upward call to make them holy. And so every story presents us with a unique masterpiece that God is writing.
The Journey Home, tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And lots more questions, so off we go to the questions. Brett sent this one in. Brett said, I worry about bad breath, especially as an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion. I want to put a Listerine breath strip on my tongue shortly before I go up as an extraordinary minister. Is this licit before receiving communion?
So I would say, yeah, it's licit. What the Code of Canon Law says, and I want to say this is Canon 919, is that the faithful are to abstain for an hour before receiving communion from food and drink. And then it notes water and medicine are exceptions. But what we're to abstain from is food and drink. And it omits it, but it points out water's an exception to the drink. And then food is not really, medicine is not really food, but it's they want to point out, hey, take your meds. So that's why that's there, even though medicine is not food.
Okay.
They just want to avoid any confusion on that point. Well, breath spray and breath strips and mouthwash are not food. You are not nourishing your body by taking those. So it doesn't fall, they don't fall into the category of food and drink any more than other things that you might put in your mouth would be food and drink that are not meant to nourish the body in some way. So, you know, like if you sloshed your mouth with motor oil, okay, that's not nourishing your body. It's not going to taste very good either, but it's not food or drink. And because you're not getting any nourishment from sloshing motor oil around your mouth. Same thing if you rinsed your mouth with alcohol or something, which will hurt like heck if you've got any cuts in your mouth. But, you know, if you were disinfecting your mouth that way, you know, and sometimes they, you know, like dentists, if you got a tooth abscess or something, they may give you something to slosh around in your mouth as a disinfectant. Well, it's not nourishing your body. It's therefore not food or drink. And so mouthwash, breath spray, breath strips, it's not food or drink. You're not taking it for the purpose of nourishment. And therefore, I would say it is not prohibited by the code of canon law.
Brett, thank you for the question. Jimmy, you've been doing this a lot longer than I've been doing it. But you don't often see a question you have not seen before. I have not seen that question before.
No, really?
You may have, but...
Well, I've not only seen the question before, I've lived the question before.
Ah,
because yeah. I'm going to Mass. Do I want to freshen my breath first? Well, I can, because I'm not. This is not food or drink. So I've already considered it just from my own experience.
Again, Brett, thanks for the question. This one comes from Kelly. Hi, Jimmy. If Adam and Eve had not sinned and brought death upon us, how are we supposed to end up in heaven? Were we to stay in the Garden of Eden for eternity?
Well, this involves a major counterfactual, which is if they had not fallen into sin, because that's not what happened in our timeline. So we're dealing with an alternate history question here. And as always, the truth is we don't know very much about alternate timelines because God has not told us what would happen in them. All we can do is speculate. But I think there is a data point that is relevant to speculating here. The church's liturgy refers to Adam's fall as a felix culpa. Culpa means fault, and felix means happy. So the church's liturgy, and I want to say this is part of the Holy Week liturgy. It could be part of the Christmas liturgy, but I think it's the Holy Week liturgy. It refers to the... It refers to the fall as a happy fault. The idea being that mankind ended up benefiting more from the fall than it would have benefited if Adam and Eve had never sinned. So the idea, this is at least a common idea historically, is that that if Adam and Eve had not sinned, if our first parents had not sinned, then we would have remained in the garden. And that would have been a good existence. It would have been literally paradisical, but it wouldn't have been as good as Christ becoming one of us and redeeming us and uniting us with God on this higher spiritual level. And so, so at least according to the common idea, mankind would have had a blessed destiny in the garden, which may have grown to cover the whole earth or something, but we would have had a blessed destiny without the fall, but we have an elevated, even better supernatural destiny as a result of the redemption, which is conditional on the fall. And so the idea is that actually we benefited. Adam's fall was a felix culpa. It was a happy fault that ended up giving us a better destiny than we would have had otherwise. Now, that's, you know, you could speculate in other ways. You could say, well, maybe we would have had the full destiny that we do now anyway, but that's not how it's traditionally been regarded.
Kelly, Thank you very much. Appreciate the question. On we go. John asks this. My wife wondered if Moses might have time traveled to be with Jesus at the Transfiguration, either at the end of his life or when he was with God getting the laws or in the tent of meeting. After all, there was the glory of God at the Transfiguration, and Moses's face glowed after being with God.
Yeah, so I'm a big time travel fan. The laws of physics do not prevent travel into the past. They certainly don't prevent travel into the future. We all travel into the future at the rate of 1 second per second. And you can even affect the rate at which you progress into the future through relativistic effects, like by flying near the speed of light or by flying into a gravity well or out of a gravity well. You can change that 1 second per second rate depending on the frame of reference you pick to measure it with. So, you know, the trick would then be getting back to your own time, and that would involve to your original time, and that would involve time travel into the past, which is not prohibited by the laws of nature. In fact, it seems to kind of be expected by, you know, what we understand from Einstein's theory of relativity. But we don't know how to do it, at least not yet. So I'm a fan of time travel, but I'm also a fan of interpreting texts the way they would have been understood by the original audience. And the original audience reading about the Transfiguration would not have understood it as time travel, because Moses dies at the end of Deuteronomy, and then something weird happens with his body, because Jude refers to the devil and Saint Michael disputing over Moses' body. And then they see, Peter, James, and John see Moses along with Elijah at the Transfiguration. This would not have been understood in terms of time travel. Now, I can't rule it out that it was time travel, that God plucked Moses from some time before he died, brought him to the Transfiguration, and then put him back. I can't, that's within God's power, so I can't say 100% that didn't happen, but I can say that's not how this text would have been understood, because people in the past did not have the concept of time travel. The idea of space and time being malleable is something that really only became accepted in popular consciousness after Einstein. So after the early 20th century, there had been a few experiments with time travel in fiction, like Mark Twain's King Arthur or Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. But the way time travel worked there is essentially magic. And so time travel was really not part of the mental map that the original readers of the Gospels had. And so they would assume that this is the spirit, possibly reunited with the body of Moses in continuity from the past. It's not plucked out of the past and brought here. It's like, this is the spirit of Moses as it is today. Or this is the spirit and body of Moses as it is today, not dislocated in time. And since that's what the original audience would have assumed, and that's what the original author would have assumed, I think we need to stick with that unless we have good reason to think otherwise, and I don't see good reason to think otherwise here.
Is it interesting to you, Jimmy, that both Moses and Elijah, who are with Jesus, seem to have some unusual event with their body at the end of their, end of their life?
Because Elijah gets assumed in heaven.
Yeah.
He goes up in a whirlwind. You often hear about him riding in God's chariot, but that's not actually what happens. God's chariot shows up when Moses ascends, but he's caught up in a whirlwind. Elijah. Yeah, I'm sorry. Elijah gets caught up in a whirlwind for the actual event. It is interesting they both have unusual circumstances connected with what you otherwise would think of as their death. I think the real reason they're both here, they represent the law and the prophets. Moses represents the law, Elijah represents the prophets, and so this shows us how the law and the prophets both testify to Jesus.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions. Thanks, everybody. I know there are more, but we'll have more internet open forums with Jimmy throughout the year. Happy New Year, Jimmy.
Happy New Year, Cy Kellett, and to all the audience as well.
As well, and looking forward to lots more mysterious world, weird questions, Bible questions with Jimmy Akin all throughout the new year. That will do it for us for today. We will be back tomorrow with more live radio, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.